This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. For survivors of rape, taking a case to court can exact a heavy physical and mental toll due to intimidation by the accused or a lack of support from family members. Furthermore, a survey conducted by the Women's Centre for Change, or WCC, revealed that only 4% of cases involving sex abuse resulted in guilty verdicts, while almost half will end in discharge, not amounting to an acquittal. WCC's Senior Advocacy Officer Melissa Mohammed Akhir is here to talk about a new campaign to make the legal system less intimidating for survivors of sex abuse. Melissa, that WCC survey was done in 2004. Has the trend improved in the decades since?
Well, first of all, thank you for having us. And the question regarding the survey, so because the survey was done over a five-year period, but the results were published in 2009, but we see that the trend, as in the numbers, the single digits, have been consistent. However, we haven't done a new survey since. Instead, we have moved on to another survey, which was released last year. This is on rights in court, more on the what facilities and what measures will be able to reduce the scary experience of going to court. So that one we did last year. However, on trends, we can see also across the board, all over countries, usually even in Western countries, the numbers are still in the single digits.
Why? What is the reason for that conviction rate being so low?
One of the main reasons is the amount of persons who drop out, or the legal term is called discharge not amounting to acquittal. So this means that for whatever reason, the case can't continue. For example, witnesses don't turn up. The prosecutors cannot continue because of some evidence issues. But mostly we tend to center on the victim's experience of the court process, where people just give up and tend to drop out.
That sense of, you know, having that number there, that 4%, or, you know, being in the single low digit percentage, and the fact that people kind of stop attending or drop out, does that make it even more discouraging for a survivor to step forward and report a crime, you know, knowing that those factors are present?
Well, actually, if you ask the men on the street, they don't memorize the statistics. We use the numbers more for the agencies, maybe for Ways Forward, so that we can improve the access to justice. But for the men on the street, usually it's what they experience. So what I mean is that from the first point, when you experience the crime, let's say you experience a rape, how are you treated when you go forward to the police or you go to a hospital to get treatment? So that experience, going to court, and how many times you have to go to court, that is the more discouraging aspect rather than the numbers. Because usually you will say that the numbers are for cases in the past, didn't happen to you. Most people will tend to personalize the experience, especially if there's re-traumatization. That means you've gone through the offense, you've gone through the crime, and you suffer again from how you're treated. That would be the main criteria of why people drop out or give up, especially when they don't receive support.
What are the factors surrounding the reluctance on the survivor's part to report a crime? I mean, it would seem like, I think to people who haven't gone through this, it would seem like a very natural impulse. It's like something terrible happened to you, you want to see justice served. But what other kind of things start to enter the picture once the process is begun or even before it begins?
Yeah, so when before a crime has happened, let's just take if it happened to us, yeah? So as a woman walking on the street, suddenly you suffer a crime. So in theory, you think it might be easy to go to the police and all that. But once it has happened, when you suffer from the shock, the trauma of the offense itself, then you go to report and how people speak to you. Sometimes people have verbalized that they're treated like they are the offenders, like they're criminals. Yeah, so from the start, from the front desk itself, and then if you're referred to other places and you feel like you're a ball being kicked around, that doesn't help. So these are just specific examples of when we say secondary trauma, where you are treated horribly, and the court experience itself, questioning itself, waiting time itself. Cases can take years. So this can cause reluctance. But positively, we found that cases where from the start, positively there's support, then you gain the strength to go ahead and continue because it's not easy. They're accessing justice through our criminal justice system is not that easy. You really need all the support you can get.
The ball being kicked around, that description, is that true regardless of how much support you have? I mean, is it inevitable that if you try to push a complaint through the court process, that that is going to happen to you?
Again, I can't sweepingly say that all experiences are bad. We've even had some positive, for example, in a particular case, we've had a client receive a protection order within 24 hours, which is excellent, even internationally. So sometimes when you meet the good officers, for example, handling your case, cases can go smoothly. And there's been a working relationship between NGOs such as us with the various agencies, especially the hospitals. And later on, I'll describe something called the One-Stop Crisis Center, where things can proceed smoothly. And when victims are not aware of their rights, but are helped, where people journey together with them, and it goes on to access the justice more efficiently.
This initiative to make the process of going through the court system less intimidating, it began life as a guidebook. Why did you think a series of videos was necessary as well?
Yeah, if you can see the book visually compared to a video, of course there's more words in the book. And we find that in the video, it's better to have it as a sort of conversation because there's a host, Sarima Ibrahim is the host. So she explains things, and when the illustrations, as in the cartoons, of the victims with her friends, with her family, and some of the visuals can crystallize or condense the court process. So that means we even have a sort of journey through the court process, and it works like a snake and ladder thing. So you, what happens? Why did I have to wait for so long? What are all the stages of the criminal trial? So it's more public friendly in that way.
In the event of a rape or a sexual assault, what should a survivor do right away?
The simple answer is actually to head to a government hospital. So just now I mentioned the one-stop crisis centre. This means that all districts in Malaysia are supposed to have a hospital. The emergency unit usually is called A&E, Accident Emergency, where as a victim, all the parties are supposed to go and see you there at the hospital. So the police is supposed to come and see you there. The social welfare department is supposed to come and see you there. And when I mean the hospital is whatever evidence can be preserved and can be collected from you without you having to run around, again, like we said, like the ball. Yeah. So this system, this mechanism, has actually been praised in Southeast Asia. We're one of the first that has done it. But it's supposed to progress smoothly all over Malaysia.
Moving forward from that, how much would it cost me to hire a lawyer?
Okay, this depends on what it means, like what is your need. Assuming you are a victim of a rape case, so it usually depends on the activity that you need. If you need a protection order so that the perpetrator doesn't come and harass you, or there's some sort of condition that the court imposes, nobody can intimidate you. So that's one proceeding, yeah? So usually now, there's actually no specific system for victims in Malaysia. We don't have a victims fund. But the rates that WCC is trying to propose now is based on what the National Legal Aid Foundation has imposed on persons who are suspects. So example, one proceeding is 80 ringgit. So overall, we will see what is considered in your case, what is needed in your case, and tally it up. But we are trying to not to have it as a right for victims of crime, which goes across the board. As is basis right now, our clients who can afford it are paying it on their own in one lump sum, but it also depends on the experience of the lawyer. So that's why I don't have a short answer right now.
What are the different processes that victims of rape or sexual assault usually proceed with? So there is, as you say, the protection order.
Yeah.
What else?
Okay, so you can also ask for the special measures before the trial begins. For example, if you are below 16, there is a law that says that you can get all the protection available in court, so you don't have to look in the face of the perpetrator when you're telling the story of the sexual assault, because clearly this can be scary. So there's something called, for example, the video live link, where you sit in another room and you ask questions from another room, which might not be as intimidating as the courtroom setting. So that's usually used for children, although it can also be for adults, especially rape victims, because they're highly traumatized or the level of vulnerability is high. So these are what we mean when, although there are government officers in place, but to make the process smoother, sometimes we need a lawyer who does a watching brief in the case, who may sort this out. Or sometimes through WCC, we try and advocate for these rights to be in place before the trial even begins.
How much evidence do I need to bring a case to court? I mean, assuming that I do everything right, I go to the government hospital, it starts there. What else do I need to kind of proceed?
Yeah. So we had explained what is actually physically collected from you. And because it's a sexual crime case, currently our laws is highly dependent on the person, the victim or the complainant. Yeah. And after that is what else is observed of your behavior. For example, did you explain to a loved one or did they observe you the level of trauma? Although people respond to trauma differently, but it's good as soon as possible when there's someone else who can support that you were consistent. So it's just for consistency. But still, of course, from a human rights point of view, we're trying to say, even if there's one complainant, you should be believed. Yeah, so because the criminal process needs such a high standard of beyond reasonable doubt, so that's why we're saying all the support possible. So in the case of children, for example, teachers have come forward to support because they've observed the child's behaviour, which is consistent with someone who has gone through trauma. Yeah, so I hope this is not too much legalese. But yes, as many of your support system as possible, as early as possible, of what they observed.
I'm speaking today with Melissa Mohammed Akhir, Senior Advocacy Officer at the Women's Centre for Change, or WCC. We're talking about a new campaign to make the legal system less intimidating for survivors of sex abuse. Up next, the importance of the police report. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and in the studio with me, Melissa Mohammed Akhir, Senior Advocacy Officer at the Women's Centre for Change, or the WCC. And we're talking about assisting survivors of sex abuse to survive the court process as well. Now, you also encourage witnesses of a crime to step forward and make a police report, not just the survivors. During the police investigation and in court, are testimonies valued less compared to physical evidence? I mean, you spoke earlier of how it's important to have that kind of corroborating support in your story.
Okay, so although we say the testimony of a victim should actually be enough, but to get the best case possible, what we mean is witnesses, other people who have observed. Sometimes it's a sibling, yeah? Sometimes it's a friend. So what we mean is other than the physical evidence that's obtained, other people can also show consistency of the evidence. And please bear with me, it's also called the best evidence rule. When a person is sworn in, comes to court, and verbally explains something, and more importantly, is cross-examined by a lawyer. So that's the test that you have to go through compared to the physical evidence where you can't cross-examine the physical evidence. So in that way, we're still classically bound by the adversarial system of the court systems. So that's why we encourage persons to come forward. But for a more human perspective, it's also support. You're supporting someone. So when we've had cases, for example, when a babysitter's husband was allegedly accused of abusing a child, the other children there, the kindergarten teacher who was there. So these are support measures, and sometimes neighbours. So the neighbours who come forward actually say, yeah, but this misfortune didn't happen to my child, but I should support it because it's also children, yeah? So this is what we mean.
But when it comes to sexual abuse cases, I think one thing that tends to come up is, even if you are not the victim and you're a witness, you're scared to come forward because of this idea that you are under cross-examination. Everything about you can now be brought up. Are defense lawyers allowed to bring up a witness's personal history, medical record and so on, and question his or her credibility in court?
Yeah, so this is a particular area where we think we should update our evidence laws. So for now, the rule is all those things you mentioned can be brought up when they are related to the charge. What is the offence that is brought to court? So there's also some restrictions where things that are not relevant or your personal history with another person that's unrelated to the offence definitely can't be brought up. All the lawyers have tried sometimes. They've tried to say that you are of a loose character and all that by saying that you go out at night, for example. But it has to be related to the offence, actually, under the law. Okay. That being so, we still think that the ethical requirements of the court process should still come in. This is where we're trying to improve the Evidence Act to still take into account secondary victimization. I will keep repeating this phrase because some people have said, and we have case laws, where they said the ordeal of being questioned itself can be worse than being raped. So our local judge has said that, Datuk Sheh Dawood, if I'm not wrong. So this is where we have to take this and improve our laws. And in fact, we've been engaging with the Aegis Chambers to improve our evidence laws to not be so discriminatory towards victims.
What about witnesses? I mean, what are the rights of witnesses? Can, for example, the alleged perpetrator contact them, maybe intimidate them, talk to them?
Yeah, so generally, if there's a victim's charter, there was actually a code of conduct for prosecutors where witnesses for the prosecution are not supposed to be intimidated and all reasonable measures to protect them must be taken. And positively, it seems like it's in the works within the criminal procedure code, but of course, it has to be balanced with the rights of the accused, as in for the lawyer to question. Again, there are ethical considerations, even when we're studying law, on how you question a person. So there's some things like scandalous questions, insulting, humiliating questions are not supposed to be allowed. So this one, we need to see it more in practice rather than just on the letter of the law.
A sexual assault is obviously a traumatic event. How does the court account for the reliability of a survivor's memory? I mean, is the burden too great to expect somebody to be able to detail every single thing that happened?
This is a really good question, especially if the trial itself has actually proceeded 4 years after the event. So the level of testing or how you're tested through the questioning, sometimes is unrealistic for a particular victim's experience. Sometimes you may have suffered from many coping or survival mechanisms, like if you have post-traumatic stress disorder. So sometimes you can't go to the detail of which particular hand did touch where first and all that. So such details are sometimes unrealistic. So this is where we encourage a lot of training and a lot of taking into account of expert evidence on these areas. Because sometimes we tend, again, like we said, we tend to just use simple logic, which doesn't apply. There's no one response to a sexual crime. There's many, many responses. Sometimes you blank things out. Yeah. So we need to bring in the experts, one who have seen the victim as a patient, but also on other findings on how people respond. Like, sometimes the logic that is used is, oh, you've suffered a rape, you must immediately run and report. That is actually very rare. Research has shown it has gone through the gap of, say, 2 weeks before someone reports. It's very natural because of what you go through following an event, the trauma that you go through.
How long would you say a typical investigation takes, and how many cases just end up being unsolved or unresolved?
A typical investigation, for the police, they have a timeline of 2 weeks for each particular updates. So 2 weeks to 1 month, we will say the estimate, for at least the initial part of the investigation. For cases that go unsolved, unfortunately, now we are seeing a trend of, let's say, adult rape victims. We are seeing less and less. So when before this a question on unreporting or cases that disappear, we're seeing less and less cases of women who are raped coming forward for the courts. We are seeing more cases of child sexual abuse. But to say that how many the numbers are would involve, a sociological research, which we don't have right now. But we are seeing a trend, the missing women.
Are court cases open to the public and reporters?
So this depends on the case. There is a law that says cases that are particularly sensitive and cases involving children are supposed to be in closed court. So generally, yes, court cases are open unless there are considerations to the level of vulnerability in the case.
But would the identities of rape survivors be protected?
Identities of rape survivors, if they are children, is automatically covered under the law. So again, the Evidence of Child Witnesses Act 2007 says that no one shall publish unless the court orders otherwise. For example, in the case of a missing child. So after the child has been raped, the child is missing and they want to detect the child, for example. But for adult women, usually the details can come out unless a request is made to the court. And a request can be made, again, as I said, using the law that says this is a sensitive, traumatizing case. And then the court can order, okay, for media, please blank out the names or the details.
Would there be counseling for survivors at any point of the process?
For NGOs, we do provide, and I believe the Social Welfare Department and even some areas of the police unit, it's called D11, but they're a unit that handles sexual cases as well. However, the long-term counselling is where we're trying to see whether it's continuous or whether it's comprehensive. For WCC, we will journey together with the client and provide consistent counselling. So maybe for the phone numbers, because we provide counselling for all over Malaysia, and the numbers are 04228-0342.
How should survivors prepare in advance of a court case? If, you know, finally it's come, they know that they're going to be headed into court, what should they be doing to prepare themselves?
Yeah. So, again, the timeline usually is around 2 weeks. And you can see a pattern. You'll get more and more nervous right before a case, right? So, if you have contacted WCC, we try, again, to get the special measures, your rights in place. So, precisely what are your needs? You don't want your name to come out. You don't want to see the perpetrator. You need a translator. Maybe you only speak Mandarin. So all these things we try to sort out at least 2 weeks before. And there's something called the subpoena, which is actually the court order ordering you to come as a witness. That should actually be served to you because let's say if you're working, then you need time off. Yeah, so all these things must be in place. And when we mentioning the video, if you can view the video, if you can understand your rights and remind the government officer, for example, the prosecutor in court, to ensure that you get these rights in court, as simple as sometimes a whiteboard screen, shielding you. So arranging all these things. And as mentioned earlier, the intimidation. If there has been any approach or intimidation, actually a police report can be done to refer this to the prosecutor to protect you. And that can go to the extent of revoking bail. So that it's actually a rule that when someone gets bail, they cannot intimidate the other side, the prosecution witnesses. So these are your rights. Rights to feel safe, rights to be able to go to court and tell the account of what happened without fear.
What happens after the court process?
So after the court process, if you're a victim, usually, if the case has been convicted, you are given the chance to write the impact of the crime on yourself, the victim impact statement. So you can explain the pain and suffering you had gone through. If the case is 4 years, that means you can write from what happened earlier, if you had to see a psychiatrist, how long you had to traipse up and down the court and all that. You were not able to sleep, stuff like that. So you can write it down. You can verbally explain to the judge, or you can have the prosecutor or another family member read it out in court. So this usually goes to sentencing because the court is supposed to assess what was the impact of the crime that was done. So if it's rape, what was the impact of the rape on you? So that's one of the consideration for punishment. But also later on, how does this benefit a victim, for example? There is something called compensation for the offence that has been caused. So this is where if you've gone to the doctor, save all the costs that you've gone through. But some of the impact may be more emotional. So this one also, if you can, it can be assessed by someone, again, a doctor, that would be better because it's in a document. But there are rights even after. And for WCC, we do try to balance the legal aspects with the healing and recovery aspects, with the moving on aspects. Because everyone needs to survive and needs to move on.
Are survivors ever encouraged to settle a case out of court?
Because for WCC, we operate from a rights-based perspective. So we try and say access to justice would be available. But understanding of justice might differ from person to person. So if in the circumstances of the client's case, they think settling is the best option, It usually depends on the person. We do not say at all costs you have to go through the court process, because definitely we cannot guarantee that it will be a fast, painless exercise. It might be very painful. So for NGOs, we support, but the choices are made by the person going through the experience.
And of course, the worst possible outcome of all would be you've gone through the whole process, it's been painful and traumatic, and then the court rules that the accused is not guilty.
Okay.
Once that happens, what options do survivors have?
Unfortunately, this is still a reality, but we have to say we've also had cases of successes. So in the case where someone has been acquitted, set free by the court, and you're not happy with it, you think that you've provided the best evidence possible, it is an option as the person who has suffered through the experience to put in a request to the Aegis Chambers, to the prosecution, that the case go for an appeal, although it is up to their discretion. So that's one, right, to request that it goes for appeal. So appeal means there's two other stages, two other chances, whether the case can be, the accused can be found guilty. Other than that, maybe you can also explore other avenues, whether legal or otherwise. And some people have even gone on to support groups. Because, for example, if you're a father of a child that has been abused, but the accused has been set free, but you found that there are other children that have been similarly abused. So maybe there's we can group together and explore other avenues to improve things so that this doesn't happen again, so that the perpetrator doesn't re-offend. And all that. But I don't mean vigilante groups. I mean the improvements in how we handle cases involving, because acquittals can sometimes mean tiny technical details in the law. Doesn't mean that the crime does not happen. So we always advise that to the families who go through acquittals.
What about my immediate safety in the aftermath? You know, I might be extra fearful because this person has hurt me once. I've dragged them through the courts, you know, and maybe they were acquitted, as you say, on a technicality.
Okay.
But now, I mean, it's an open world. You know, he might know where I live. He might know where I work. What about my safety?
Okay, early on we mentioned protective orders. So the unfortunate fact is in most cases, perpetrators are known to the victim. Some cases, they're family members. If they're family members, actually you can get protective orders under the Domestic Violence Act, which may mean once the person is charged of a crime, there's some protective orders, cannot approach within 500 meters, cannot contact via any means and all that. So even if after the person has been acquitted, but if they've breached those orders, it's actually a crime. So you can protect yourself using that order, as in if there's a breach, you run quickly, get the person arrested for breaching that order. But if the perpetrator is not a family member, but the victim is a child, there's also protection for children, also protective orders. But what we mean is what is better might be monitoring and supervision. So for children, they're supposed to be child protectors who observe the situation and remove the danger, because we're not supposed to allow abuses to happen again. So these are some of the avenues. But of course, if you notice when I mention it, what about strangers who have perpetrated crimes against adult women? That one we're still exploring on injunction orders. This is the legal avenue. But other than that, your support group must be in place. You must have families or neighbours or even groups like NGOs that can support you on your safety and advise you on your options on safety.
What legal recourse do survivors of marital rape have? You know, earlier we talked about how most rapists or perpetrators are known. But of course, marital rape is something that continues to be controversial here.
So for marital rape, just to clarify, within our laws, if there was any threat of hurt or there is actually hurt, as in injuries caused, it's actually still recognized as a rape, even though perpetrated by your spouse. However, sometimes proving hurt might be hard. And maybe in that case where the case is not pursued, you can find there's some recourse for complaining of harm that is caused to you. So, example, even in Islamic family law, in Sharia, there's a rule that you cannot mistreat your wife. When you marry, there's actually a contract that you sign during the nikah process. So then you can complain to a judge. So even if the criminal case is not pursued, there's other avenues so that you're not bothered by the other side. Or you can try for civil recourse. And in some cases, usually you can get mediation within the family members. So usually the situation is one of extreme disrespect and mistreatment. So you might get, if the spouse can be referred for counseling or therapy for rehabilitation of the behavior. But this is particularly difficult if one doesn't want to acknowledge your offense. Yeah, so we have to try and see what are the circumstances of the case.
And finally, we don't have laws protecting against sexual harassment in the country. What options do victims of sexual harassment have?
Okay, so currently, all that we have is under the Employment Act. So within the confines of your workspace, there may be avenues when there is sexual harassment. However, these avenues are very limited. And in fact, it can only give you recourse to say you can resign, but they can't cut off your salary for complaining about the sexual harassment. So there's no actually like, say, punishment or compensation that is paid to you. So again, very limited rights. So you're right in that there's almost unclear laws protecting on sexual harassment. But if you have suffered some sort of injury, what I mean by injury is even if it's mental pressure on you, causing you unable to work, some people have taken to suing the other party in court. Yeah, so this depends on the degree, again, what we say, of the recording of what suffering you have gone through and to show it to court. The more when you have documented evidence, even better for to take action in court. So this is the current avenue, other than for activists at large who are still lobbying for a standalone sexual harassment act that covers all spheres, not just employment, not just at workspaces.
And finally, where can people go to get more information on all this?
So for WCC Penang, we are actually on Facebook. So you can actually post just simple messages to us if you can find us on WCC Penang. Other than that, we have a website. And on our website, on the main page, our website, you can browse and find wccpenang.org. Okay. So on the main page, on the landing page, there's actually a cartoon and it says Surviving Court. So if you click on that cartoon, you will get access to the videos and there's options for the language that you want. So the video is actually subtitled in 4 languages. So you can even choose Mandarin or Tamil if you want. And it's also subtitled in BM in case you can't hear the audio. The audio is in BM, in Bahasa.
Thank you very much for coming in, Melissa. I've been speaking with Melissa Mohammed Akhir, Senior Advocacy Officer at the Women's Centre for Change, WCC. We've been talking about surviving the court process for survivors of sex abuse. You've been listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.